So tonight I'm going to talk about the cycle of healing. And I'll say first of all that primarily I'm going to talk about emotional pain, not physical pain, although some of what I say might be applicable to physical pain, but there really is a huge difference. And the difference is, and it might sound funny to say this, but the blessing of physical pain is that we can't avoid it. Physical pain is in our face, and we have to deal with it one way or another, getting, you know, some kind of treatment or medication or whatever. There's very little hiding from physical pain. By contrast, emotional pain, we have thousands of ways to hide from it and thousands of ways to pretend that it's not there. And so that's why healing emotional pain is a much more complicated topic. There's actually not much to say about the topic of physical pain, like get help, you know, like that sort of thing. But none of us have any doubt about that. But emotional pain is very tricky that way. And that's primarily the focus of this talk. And I'll just say briefly, we live in a, you know, it's the nature of the human mind, first of all, that we have such a profound, ingenious capacity for self-deception and self-delusion. And that's existed from time immemorial. But what's been added in our own culture, incrementally over the past century, is just thousands of ways to distract ourselves. Our society is sated with ways to distract ourselves. And so among the things that people use to hide from pain, certainly drug and alcohol. Another huge addiction is entertainment, you know, movies, TVs, video games. And I view entertainment much in the same way that I view alcohol. You know, in other words, if I have a drink a week, a drink every other week, that's not an alcohol problem. If I'm having five or six drinks a day, that's an alcohol problem, you know? And much in the same way, if someone's watching one show a week or something like that, or playing 1 hour of video games a week, that's not really a problem. But if it's filling hours and hours of every single day, that's a problem.
So what you're saying that 99% of Americans have a problem?
Yes. We live in a very addicted culture. Another way that people hide from pain is drama, which is just completely projecting it outward. You know, I can't believe that she said this about him, you know, and it's all projected outward so that I'm looking at the problem out there and worried and concerned about the problem out there. Totally, where it's totally othered from me, where I have to take no responsibility for it. So those are some of the more popular ways of avoiding pain. And I'll say also just living in the head. We live in a very head-driven, verbally-driven society. There are a number of people who are very keen thinkers, but who are not in touch with their feelings. And certainly that described me, you know, decades ago. Living in the head is a choice of leaving the body. Leaving the body, leaving the emotionality, leaving the vulnerability, which would bring us in contact with the pain. So the beginning of the healing the journey, when we start out, when someone starts out and they realize they want to move toward healing, typically people start in one of two places. Either they're in a place of overwhelmed by pain, and that can be because of some kind of trauma, you know, internal or external, or they start out kind of numb and stuck. And so the first task for the numb, stuck person, and in many ways, that describes much of my journeys, starting out from a place of numb and stuck and why am I stuck? There's just a lot of listening and a lot of feeling into it. It's almost one has to heroically journey toward the pain. The person who's in the place of overwhelm, they have no doubt where the pain is. Really, the first task for them is setting some kind of boundaries, setting some kind of space so that they're not purely in the overwhelm. And I think it's worthwhile saying there's this kind of color code that we use in education to describe the experience of students. Red, yellow, and green, yellow, red. And probably this is reasonably familiar. Green is something where it's a comfort zone. That's where everything is comfortable. I'm not asking the students anything that challenges them all that much. They're comfortable and happy. Yellow is where they're being stretched. Red is where they're completely overwhelmed. And of course, very little learning happens in the green zone and very little learning happens in the red zone. And so the part of the art of teaching is to figure out how to keep kids in that right place of stretch where they're not overwhelmed, but they're learning as much as they can.
Do you consider books an addiction problem?
I think it really depends on the kind of book. That's a much deeper question, and there are thousands of different kinds of books. So I was going to say that really our goal with ourselves in the growth process, in the healing process, is to keep ourselves in the yellow zone as much as possible, you know? And so on the one hand, for the person that's in the overwhelm, it's important to set the boundaries so that they're not in red all the time, because growth is not really going to happen when we're in red. But for the person who's numb and stuck, probably they're numb and stuck because they've been in the green zone too long. And they need to move out of the green zone, out of their comfort zone. And so all of healing is about, you might say, moving toward pain, moving toward a relationship with the places that are in pain, moving toward a conversation. But I want to be very careful to specify, especially in our verbally driven culture, pain often has a verbal presentation in our psyche. It's often called an inner critic or something like that. And these are the messages that pain sends up. And these messages are things like you're worthless or your life is never going to amount to anything or, you know, blah, blah, blah. The messages of pain. And the first thing I'll say is that I often like to say that pain is the great internal advertising agency. And like advertisement, the message of pain is loud, it's frequently repeated, and it has little or no truth content. And I think really to understand the dynamic, it's very important to consider the analogy to, say, a young child, say a two-year-old, who's in a moment of dysregulation and they're in full temper tantrum. Okay? Now, a child in full temper tantrum might say things like, I hate you, mommy and daddy. It would be a very abusive, damaging parent who took that message literally. You know, you hate me, well, I'll show you, you know, like that kind of thing. And it would also be dysfunctional for a parent to try and reason with the child and respond with logic. Well, how can you say you hate me? You were laughing earlier. Like that sort of thing. What a wise parent does is pretty much discounts the verbal content of what the kid is saying and attends to the kid's real needs. And I think it's important to understand from the point of view of the kid. Now, not that the kid is able to conceptualize this and think this through, but essentially, the kid, you might say that even the saying, mommy and daddy, I hate you, is a kind of bid for connection. In other words, I'm in a bad place. I don't understand my bad place. I'm going to say things that I think will put you in a bad place. And then at least if you're in the bad place with me, I'm not alone. And then maybe because you're the grown-up, you'll know how to fix the bad place. Like, essentially, that's kind of the kid logic. And that's very much the logic of our wounded places within. The wounded places within that are sending up the inner critic type messages. It's ironic to say, but the inner critic message is in a way a bid for connection. You know, in other words, the infantile, and usually it's an infantile wounded place, the infantile wounded place is feeling bad, is feeling emotionally dysregulated, turns to the grown-up in the psyche. The ego is essentially the grown-up in the room in the psyche, and sends these messages wanting to create that a bad kind of feeling in ego. And then again, maybe if the grown-up feels bad the way I feel, maybe the grown-up will know what to do with it, that kind of thing. One of the things that really blocks healing in this society, in this very head-driven society, is people get the messages of pain, they get the messages of the inner critic, and they start thinking about it logically. And they start, you know, basing, you know, drawing logic, you know, all right, well, if I am worthless, then this must be true. And then, you know, like drawing deductions from it as if it were truth. And it's so important to have this kind of wise parent relationship to places of pain. The words don't matter, you know, to see through that. Like the word, what's real is the pain, but the message of pain has no truth content to it. And so once we learn the skill of discounting the verbal content that comes from pain, it's about connecting with it. It's about opening a conversation. And of course, as we all know, there's no formula for a conversation. You know, I recently started a job, and in the course of that job, I met, I don't know, 50 or 60 new adults, my colleagues. And of course, in every case, meeting a new person is a new conversation. And some of those conversations move very quickly to a playful place and we're laughing. Some move to this, to an intellectually interesting place. Some are very guarded. You know, everyone's different. And so there's always something unique about, you don't know what's going to happen when a conversation opens.
Nobody spoke about God at your school.
Oh, there's all kinds of talks about that. Yes. When we're talking to, when we're, as it were, opening a conversation with the places within us, those are places that have experienced trauma. And so it's a different kind of skill set. You know, it's one thing when I'm talking to my colleagues who are healthy, functional adults, you know, and connecting with them. It's a very different thing. Sometimes something I have to do with my students. You know, how do you connect with someone who's been through trauma? And that usually requires a lot of listening, a lot of giving them space. Allowing is incredibly important. Just this sense of allowing. You have permission to be however you need to be right now. That kind of thing. And exactly the same as we would be connecting with a traumatized person outside of ourselves, we have to connect in that exact same way to the places within us that have been traumatized. And truly allow them to open up at their own level and to develop trust however long it takes for them to develop trust, you know. And so sometimes those processes are long, sometimes those processes are short. It is my belief, having been through this cycle many times, that every place in us is ultimately made of love and is ultimately seeking connection. The most bitter, hateful, you know, intractable kind of pain, eventually it yields, and it's not necessarily a quick process, but eventually it yields and it flowers into a kind of tenderness. It is certainly true in any conversation, just an ordinary conversation. If it's a real conversation, I'm not in control. I might be in control of a monologue, but I'm not in control of a real conversation. And so much so when we start this conversation with the otherness within us, it's a real conversation and we don't know how it's going to unfold. Often what happens as we're doing healing work is that in the process of releasing, we're releasing attachments, we're releasing beliefs, and it might even be beliefs I was never even aware that I had, you know, and all of a sudden that belief that I never even was aware that I was holding on with white knuckles, suddenly that belief is gone. And so there's a way in the healing process that I might just move into these places of, I don't know who I am at this point, or I don't know how to be, you know? And so there's all kinds of awkwardness that can be part of this, the healing process. You know, moving into the space of you know, how do I do this thing being human, or what is truly valued to me now, or how do I want to relate now? So the things that maybe never were questions suddenly become questions as you know, as the various balances of power within the psyche shift as things are released. There's a wonderful image, and part, if I had really been skillful, I would have looked for this image on the web so I could project it right now. But it's an image of the Chart Labyrinth. And what fascinates me about the labyrinth at Chart, it's one of the most famous labyrinths in the world. When you enter, there's just one little zigzag, and then you go right to the center, and you do this. You're walking right around the center. So right at the beginning, you get a taste of the end of the journey. But then as you wend through the labyrinth, you get further and further away. And eventually you're way out on the periphery. You feel 1,000 miles away from the center at that point. And then all of a sudden that leads you to the center, you know? And that is a profound metaphor for the nature of the healing journey. That, you know, there's times we think, oh, it's not going to be much. It's going to be quick, right? You know, and head loves to think these thoughts. And then it's longer. And then there's more. And then there might be periods that we feel 1,000 miles away from ever getting to any place that we want to be. And suddenly we're there, you know. It's not a process that head can understand. It's funny, the only things that head can really understand and articulate is the healing that I'm already done with. Like once I've gone on the journey, once I've done all the work, once it's a done deal, that's when head can wrap its, you know, I can wrap my head around it and articulate it. You know, anything that I'm in the middle of, head can't see because I'm in the middle of it. I have no vantage point to look from outside. And it's not, it's never a linear process. It's never a logical process the way that head envisions. It's much more circular or spiral or, you know, following the undulating lines that we see in nature.
Mike, do you want me to share the Chart labyrinth image?
Sure.
I happen to have it, but I would need screen sharing privilege, if that's not too much of a distraction. If it is, just
okay.
Yeah,
sure, go ahead, share it.
Okay.
There we go. The most famous labyrinth in the world, the Chart Labyrinth. And I don't know if you can see, but, and I don't know how I can demonstrate, you go in this little zigzag, and then right away you're going through all these sort of folds right around the center. And then as you keep on going and going, you go out further, and eventually you're way out at this periphery, feeling thousands of miles away. And then that's what leads you right into the center. And so the beginning contains a taste of the goal, but there's so much more work to get there. And, you know, and head, logical head thinks, well, I'm almost there. I must be done, you know, and you're barely beginning. Thank you. Ultimately, I don't know that the healing journey is really all that different from the spiritual journey. Healing, in some ways, you might say, is a proxy word for the divine. Much like love is, much like truth is. And my own experience is that the more I arrive, the more I pass through healing, then the more I'm just at peace with myself, the more I'm at peace with others. Part of what we're doing as we're healing is we're growing our container. And really, the way that you grow your container is just sitting what is with, you know, not, again, not with overwhelm, but just sitting with whatever is a slightly uncomfortable stretch. Whatever that slightly uncomfortable stretch is, sitting with that. And then that becomes comfortable. Then you stretch a little more and that sort of thing. And that's precisely what grows your container over time. And the more of a container I can have for my own process, the more of a container I can have for whatever I'm encountering in the world. I guess the final disclaimer I want to make is that I don't consider myself as having any kind of Buddha wisdom on this. The only reason I can say anything about the healing process is that, well, I started out as a very screwed up individual and I've been through a lot of healing in my life, you know, and so that's, you know, it's like that definition of the expert. The expert is the person who's made every possible mistake in the field, that kind of thing. So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. And let's see, I think I copied it.
There's a very different definition of an expert in the avalanche business. I mean, you cannot go through all possible mistakes.
Yeah.
The definition is that there are no experts, that all experts are bad.
That's not a bad definition either. All experts are bad.
Dead, right?
Bad, yeah.
Yeah. Nothing. Oh, all experts are dead. Yeah, the avalanche business, that might be slightly even more risky than the teaching business. So I tossed in this quote from the Book of Psalms. Psalm 126. Those who sow in tears will reap with shouts of joy. And something about that really captures very well the nature of the whole cycle of healing. This famous quote from Aeschylus: "He who learns must suffer. And even in our sleep, pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart. And in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God." Which is really this profound quote about just the nature of healing. This quote is also famous historically, and I'll just say, on the night that Dr. King was shot and killed, so this would have been April 4th, 1968, Robert Kennedy was campaigning for president, and he flew to Indianapolis that day. And when he was boarding the plane, he was told Dr. King has been shot, and they didn't know whether it was fatal or not. When he got off the plane, he was told Dr. King has died. And he was going to a primarily black neighborhood, and his aides were all saying, "Don't go, don't go, don't go." He insisted on going. He actually, you could tell, you know, he began his remarks by announcing King's death, and for many of these people, this was the first they heard of it. So they were hearing of King's death from his lips. And he spoke completely from the heart. It was the only time that he ever spoke about his own grief, publicly spoke about his own grief about losing his own brother, JFK. And he actually quoted this line from memory. He quoted this line from Aeschylus. And he quoted it with such conviction that he really seems to have connected with the crowd Indianapolis was one of the only cities that did not have race riots that night. And it seems very much the influence of RFK, who himself was shot down 3 months later. From the Sage of Amherst, Ralph Waldo Emerson, he who is not every day conquering some fear has not learned the secret of life. This wonderful one from Rilke, a very famous one from Rilke. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not seek the answer now, which cannot be given to you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you then will gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. Of course, not very comforting to the part of us that wants the answer right now, you know, that kind of thing. Khalil Gibran said, out of suffering have emerged the strongest souls. The most massive characters are seared with scars. So true. Eleanor Roosevelt, that remarkable woman, said, you gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You are able to say to yourself, I've lived through this horror. I can take on the next thing that comes along. You must do the thing you think you cannot do. From Luis Ferdinand Celine, I don't know much about him, but this person said, when you stay too long in the same place, things and people go to pot on you. They rot and start stinking for your special benefit. So just a lovely, vivid metaphor of what it is to be stuck and what motivates people to move away from stuckness. John Bowlby, the founder of attachment theory, said, the human psyche, like human bones, is strongly inclined towards self-healing. And it is true that a lot of healing is simply getting out of our own way, just being present and ego getting out of its own way, getting out of its own, you know, getting, you know, all the plans and the agendas that ego has and all the things that I think I should be doing. And I think, you know, just getting out of the way and letting the healing happen. Marion Woodman, the remarkable Jungian, said, the more you work with your dreams and your unconscious and honor it, the more you understand it and it understands you. When you develop a relationship with your psyche in this way, you begin to carry that energy into life in your relationships. And so this is part of what I was referring to last time by inner community. This idea that when we're really in this deep, authentic conversation with a number of our places of inner otherness, that there is a kind of inner warmth. And that inner warmth, by its very nature, is magnetic. On the flip side, I would say, I think a lot of the deep disconnection in this society is people who feel not only disconnected externally for whatever reason, but also feel this tremendous disconnection from their own inner otherness, you know, and there's no external happenings that can heal the pain of being disconnected from my internal otherness. Jim Rohn said, we all must suffer from one of two pains, the pain of discipline or the pain of regret. The difference is that discipline weighs ounces while regret weighs tons. The Dalai Lama said, there's a saying in Tibetan, tragedy should be utilized as a source of strength. No matter what sort of difficulties, how painful experience is if we lose our hope, that's our real disaster. Bob Dylan very simply says, behind every beautiful thing, there's been some kind of pain. And I think that's so true. I mean, look at any work of art, look at anything, you know, any beautiful human creation, music, Gothic cathedrals, there was some kind of pain that was part of that.
Behind every ugly thing, there's been some kind of pain.
That's also true, yes. That's less inspiring, but that's also true. Yes, behind every ugly thing, there's also pain. Bob Marley said, "You never know how strong you are until being strong is your only choice." And I love that one, and it really points a, kind of focuses a light on how pampered we can be and how, well, I would do healing, but I want to be comfortable, you know, like that kind of thing. Jack Kornfield said, "Grief and loss and suffering, even depression and spiritual crisis, the dark nights of the soul, only worsen when we try to ignore or deny or avoid them. The healing journey begins when we turn toward them and learn how to work with them. When we stop fighting against our difficulties and find the strength to meet our demons and difficulties head on, we often find that we emerge from our difficulties stronger and humbler and more grounded than we were before we experienced them. To survive our difficulties is to become initiated into the fraternity of wisdom." Ilana Vazant says, "When you have something to do, life will not allow you to move forward until you do it." And it is so true. There are these kind of debts to life that we need to pay. Marion Williamson said, "Personal transformation can and does have global effects. As we go, so the world goes, so the world is us. The revolution that will save us is ultimately a personal one." And it is true, the more I do my own healing work, the more healing I have to offer to everyone around me. Michael Hyatt said, "Don't feel failure. Fear being in the exact same place next year as you are today." Maladoni Patrice Somme says, very, very touching, "A person in pain is being spoken to by that part of himself that knows only how to communicate that way." You know, and it makes me think of some of the most broken students that I've encountered. You know, they present with all kinds of dysfunction. That's the only way they know of bidding for connection. And much in the same way, the places of pain within us, sometimes beat their own pain is the only thing they have to offer as a bit of connection. Tony Robbins says, "Change happens when the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change." Neil Strauss says, "People go through so much pain trying to avoid pain." So true. Elizabeth Gilbert said, "I've never seen any life transformation that didn't begin with the person in question finally getting tired of their own nonsense." Michael Barbarulo says, "God has given you the power and desire to change, but you still need to be willing to do the work. Doing the work means facing your fears and getting out of your comfort zone." Charlotte Erickson said, "Fear is the thing that makes the heart grow." Neville Rennicant says, "Most of the gains in life come from suffering in the short term so that you can get paid in the long term." John Mark Green says, "Change can be hard. It requires no extra effort to settle for the same old thing. Autopilot keeps us locked into past patterns. But transforming your life, that requires courage, commitment, and effort. It's tempting to stay camped in the zone of, that's just how it is. But to get the really good stuff in life, you have to be willing to become an explorer and an adventurer." Heather Ashamara says, "Change is inevitable, but transformation is by conscious choice." And finally, Race Momenican says, "Trauma is about stuckness. And so whenever there's stuckness in life, it's inevitable because there's some kind of trauma below." And incidentally, I think on the Google Sheet, his name is hyperlinked to his website.